Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Hello and welcome to How I Built This Lab.
Boom.
I'm Guy Raz.
There's no driver. How crazy is this?
That's crazy.
This is your first time ever. You're going to look at this as an adult when all cars are driverless. You're going to be like, yep, I did this driverless drive with Daddy.
So it's probably hard to tell from the sound alone, but what you're hearing is audio from a ride I recently took in a Waymo autonomous taxi. My son and I were in San Francisco heading across the city. These taxis are now all over San Francisco and Phoenix. And yes, there is no human driver. There's no human in the car at all, unless you count me and my son, who were passengers. It's a ghost driver. And if I'm being totally honest, they're amazing. The Waymo taxi is now available 24/7 in San Francisco and Phoenix, and it operates similar to Uber or Lyft. You pull out your phone, you fire up the app, order the car, and it magically appears within minutes, except it's fully autonomous. Waymo was spun out of Google a few years ago, but the project to build autonomous vehicles at Google actually goes back to 2009. One of the engineers on that project was Dmitry Dolgov. He's been with Waymo from the very beginning, and today he's the company's co-CEO. Dmitry was born in Russia, a child of two physics professors. He went to high school in the U.S. and eventually returned to Russia to attend the Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology. Dmitry then came back to the U.S. to get his Ph.D., in 2006, he took part in a competition called the Urban Challenge, which was sponsored by DARPA, the U.S. Defense Agency. The idea was to build an autonomous vehicle that could make it through a series of obstacle courses.
In the Grand Challenge, the Grand Challenge was to drive, 150 miles through a desert, in a completely static environment. But, until then, robots were not capable of doing that. So it took two tries in 2004 and 2005 to accomplish that. So the next step was, let's make it a little bit more interesting. Let's make the environment dynamic, right? Let's add, some rules of the road, stop signs, other vehicles, but, do it in a controlled environment in that mock city. So that was the challenge. And we built a car to do exactly that. We equipped it with a bunch of sensors, LIDARs, lasers, radars, cameras, a computer, and then wrote software that would allow it to follow the rule, understand and follow the rules of the road and interact with other, dynamic actors, whether, human or other robots.
So I'm looking at one of the vehicles that you helped put together. It's called the Junior. And it's a Volkswagen Passat, I think. And I think it came in second place. This is like 2007. And was the underlying technology basically what we're talking about today? Was it pretty similar or was it like a crude version?
Yes and no. It depends on how you talk about it. Big car plus sensors plus computers plus software, that stays. Right. But of course, it's almost 18 years since then everything has changed. Right. The sensing technology has gone a very, very long way. Computers, have evolved software, right? All the breakthroughs, especially in AI. That led to many, many breakthroughs in the area of software. So now the system we have kind of has the same components, but, all of the components and how they work together is, qualitatively drastically different.
Yeah, it's amazing how many, these DARPA challenges, how many sort of self-driving car companies they spawned. I mean, we've talked to Kyle Vogt of Cruise. He competed in the 2004 and 2005 challenges. Dave Ferguson of Nuro, which is another company, was part of the Carnegie Mellon team. Chris Urmson, who also was obviously worked with you at Waymo, he's now with Aurora, was also a part of the Carnegie Mellon team. It's amazing how many. Like, you knew all of these people, and this is, as you say, it was a small community of people working on this huge challenge to basically create vehicles that could be fully autonomous.
That's right. That's right. And of course, I worked very closely for many years with Dave and Chris, and they're great friends. So yeah, it's a lot of innovation and a lot of companies and progress came out of those early days of the ARPA Grand Challenges.
You and Sebastian Thrun and Chris Urmson, you all went to go work for Google And you were part of that founding team, which was at the time a secret project, Google's self-driving car project. And at that time, it's amazing to think 2009, because it seems like ancient history now, you were given a charge by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the co-founders of Google. You had 2 years to essentially accomplish two things. Do you remember what they were?
Yeah, I remember them very well. The first one was to drive 100,000 miles in autonomous mode. That was way more than orders of magnitude more than what anybody has done at that time. And the second one, and actually that one turned out to be more interesting and much more challenging, was to drive 10 routes. Each one was about 100 miles long, and they were very carefully selected, I think, but by Larry and Sergey. Personally, and they were fairly devious in how they created them to make it interesting. And the goal was to drive each one from beginning to end in full autonomy, so with no human intervention, which at that time seemed almost impossible. I remember we had a lot of people, even experts in the field, kind of laugh at us when we attempted it.
You had 2 years to accomplish this. I think you guys finished it with 3 months left. Like, you actually, I mean, going into this project, do you remember thinking, we're never going to do this in 2 years?
I was actually, maybe naively, but fairly optimistic.
Right.
And it was hard, and they're all different. And, yes, there are many moments where we would, finish one route and we would think ahead of, like, what would it take to do the next one? And, we would write some software, we would collect some data and test it, and then we'd actually try it and then we would hit a bunch of oh crap moments of like, okay, wow, this is way more difficult than we expected in even those early days.
So when you did finally accomplish it, were you guys able to have a party and celebrate, or was it just like, nice job, now we gotta keep it quiet?
Yes, both. We celebrated, and it felt like it was a big accomplishment. But we kept it quiet. But that's what made it so incredibly fun. I guess that phase was one of my favorite phases of the whole project. It's like the early days of a startup. You're up against what might seem like an impossible goal, but it's very clearly defined, right? You have a very clear milestone, a very clear goal. You are singularly focused on it. You have a small team. Everybody's working around the clock 24/7 and sprinting together. And every day and every hour, you're prototyping, right? You're learning. So you can move incredibly fast. And every day of every hour, you're making amazing progress and you're learning new things. So that was, that was a blast.
And every day probably presented a new series of challenges. Do you remember, what was one of the hardest challenges that you had to figure out? Like something that just took longer than you thought, that it wasn't coming together quickly on working on trying to make this happen. Do you remember something you worked on that it was like such a hard problem to solve?
There's one. I mean, we had a number. Some were more fundamentally challenging. Some were kind of even comical setbacks where, you would do a route. I remember one of the routes was driving on all of the freeways and crossing all the bridges in the Bay Area. And, it's about 100 miles and you go through all of the challenges and, we're attempting this drive. And, the car is doing a good job. It's handling merges. And
you were somebody else was sitting in the driver's, behind the wheel just in case.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And that was kind of what made those early days a lot of fun is that if you do everything, right, you would be, putting some hardware in the car, you would be calibrating the hardware, then, the next hour you're writing some software, whether it's tools or something for the car to actually make decisions. And then, you get in the car and you give it a try. So anyways, on this route, we are driving along, it's doing a job. We get almost to the very end, right? So at this point, you are holding your breath. You're waiting for, the last mile or so of that 100 mile. And the way that particular run was supposed to finish is that we're coming down the Golden Gate Bridge into the city, and there are a set of tall booths at the when you go through the bridge
as you go into the city.
That's right,
at the end of the Golden Gate Bridge, and they're narrow because I use them almost every day.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the one that our car wanted to go through was closed at the time. And it's just not something that we ever encountered and we thought about. And
oh, right, because it couldn't figure out, like, the X, the red X, or the green arrow. Like, it couldn't recognize what those meant.
That's right. And there was actually a gate, so, you know, it would stop, but it was like it would not change lanes and pick a different one. Like, oh, you know, my God, you know, now back to square one.
Because probably every, you know, it's impossible to imagine every eventuality, but something's going to come up.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we would have to deal with, you know, high speed traffic on freeways. You know, we had one route that went and kind of took this windy road from, you know, the Bay Area to Highway 1, you know, through the mountains. And, you know, we were driving along and then a bicycle fell off the truck in front of us. So, you know, that's not something that at that time the car could deal with. We had another route that went through downtown San Francisco and, you know, famous Lombard Street. That's very narrow, very windy, and has, you know, some of the most adventurous, you know, pedestrians and tourists in the world. So, you know, challenges like that, like, right? So that's what made it so challenging and so interesting, that it was the kind of the breadth of the experience.
And probably every single ride posed a new series of challenges. Like, I for example, you know, some lanes are shoulder lanes, but then during heavy traffic, they're open for driving. But the lines are painted on them in such a way that it doesn't seem like a lane. Like, a human could figure that out. But an autonomous vehicle probably at that time was like, wait, this doesn't make sense. The lines don't make sense. They don't align. Maybe the car was confused.
That's right. And that would be, you know, not the kind of situation or condition that at that time we would, you know, were able to solve robustly. It was, you know, the goal there was to learn and do. Like, we had to do the route once, right? So if you failed at something, you would go, you know, improve the system and you would try it again. So there was, a very well scoped milestone, because, you know, it 100 miles, you know, is nothing if you want to build a production system, right? But in those early days, it was long enough that it actually forces you to very deeply think and tackle, you know, some of the most fundamental, most important, you know, challenges that exist.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, more from Dmitry Dolgov on how the engineers at Waymo decided to go after the big win and create a fully autonomous vehicle. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Lab.
Hey, Guy Raz and HIBT listeners. My name is Richard Crowdy, and my favorite episode as a business professor is the founding of BET, because it summarizes business schools perfectly in keeping revenues up and keeping costs down. It also shows that a complex company like a media company can be founded by an individual that bootstraps it with the proper type of innovation. Bob Johnson is also a legend, and he's hilarious. I've actually been listening to my top 15 to try to come up with a list for my business students. So thank you, Guy Raz, and cheers.
If you want to share your favorite episode of How I Built This, record a short voice memo on your phone telling us your name, where you're from, what your favorite episode is, and why. A lot like the voice memo you just heard. And email it to us at hibt@id.wondery.com. And we'll share your favorites right here in the ad breaks in future episodes. And thanks so much. We love you guys. You're the best. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to How I Built This Lab. I'm Guy Raz. My guest today is Dmitry Dolgov, the co-CEO of the autonomous vehicle company, Waymo. I guess in those early days, the Google strategy was really on creating driver assist technologies, not necessarily fully autonomous cars, but cars that could make it easier for drivers to navigate. Basically, what you've got in, you know, in like a Tesla now or some other cars that have driver assist technologies. But I guess around 2013, there was a conscious decision to pivot the focus, because most of your testing was done on freeways.
That's right.
But what I think you guys and most people involved in the space realize is that to really create complexity, you've got to test these in cities. They've got to navigate city centers and stoplights and left turns and intersections. And so what happened in 2013 to kind of get you guys to focus, to shift your focus on building a fully autonomous vehicle instead of just driver assist technology?
Right. I would say there are, you know, a number of things. You know, as you mentioned, the first phase was, you know, just learning and understanding the complexity of the problem. Then we said, let's try to build a product. And that was the driver assist system. You know, we tried it. That was actually reasonably successful. We had ran a pilot where we gave these cars to about 100 Google employees, and they could, you know, use them to commute and take them around on their daily trips. So that was, you know, around 2011, 2012. So then, and, you know, 2013, we looked at the whole thing and we made this decision to go after full autonomy. So the reasons were, you know, several. One was what we learned from people using the driver assist system. They would overtrust it. They put on makeup and, you know, text, and, you know, one guy actually fell asleep. The car handled everything fine, but that is, you know, not what we wanted to see. So that was one of the reasons. Another one was that, you know, we actually made progress on the core, you know, most difficult aspects of this driving task on surface streets. So that, you know, gave us a bit more optimism of, you know, going after like the big prize. And this also at the same time, the field was moving forward. So if we wanted to really make an impact improve transportation, you know, globally, I thought, okay, you know, the field, you know, driver assist systems, you know, will develop. There, you know, other companies will be, you know, pushing in that direction, but let's play to our strength. Right. And let's go after the kind of uncompromising, you know, big win and, you know, big unlock in the space, which is full autonomy and actually building, you know, what we now call the Waymo driver that's responsible for the whole task of driving beginning end to end with, you know, no human behind the wheel.
What do you remember about the conversations and the ambitions? Was it like, hey, you know, let's build the technology for fully autonomous vehicles that we can then maybe one day license? Or was it, no, let's basically become a car company. Let's like make fully autonomous technology and purpose-built vehicles and, and eventually sell these to consumers that they can have for themselves. Was it either of those ambitions discussed?
I don't think we ever seriously entertained building a car. Just never made sense, you know, to me, you know, or others to, you know, do that. Like, we're not a car company. Building cars is hard.
Yeah. Right?
There's many companies that, you know, spend 100 years getting very, very good at it. You know, we did in the early days have design a low speed vehicle, you know, that we called the Firefly, because we needed to take that, you know, first. That was our 0-to-1 moment of full autonomy.
It was a prototype. It was
exactly
like that you showed out. You publicly should display it in 2014. But that wasn't the goal. It wasn't.
That's right.
We're not going to build cars. But we're going to build the technology that can power any car to become autonomous.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's, you know, it was the evolution of the thinking that then crystallized in, you know, the Waymo mission, which is, you know, to build the Waymo driver and then, you know, over time, deploy it in different products and, you know, different commercial applications, you know, whether ride hailing, trucking, deliveries, and eventually, you know, personally owned vehicles. And that's the path that we, you know, set for ourselves and the path that we've been on since that pivot in 2013.
Now, in some ways, the real work begins, because between 2013 and, let's say, 2023, right, which we're going to get to, because it's incredibly exciting what is going on now in San Francisco and Phoenix and, you know, a couple other places. But that 10-year period, it probably all of a sudden you're back to kind of startup mode, because you've got to get these cars, this technology, to be absolutely foolproof, perfect, but in complex environments like San Francisco, which I think is next to New York is one of the most complex driving environments in the United States. Tell me a little bit about the process that then began. Is that what happened? Was it a shift to like, okay, let's see what these can do in cities?
That's exactly right. We didn't start with the full complexity of San Francisco in those early days. So we can kind of think of, you know, that 10 years as maybe three phases, and kind of that correspond to three generations of our technology, you know, generations of the, you know, of our driver. You know, that first one was on that low speed vehicle. Yeah, you know, the Firefly, that's what we called the third generation of our driver.
And by the way, just to clarify, the Firefly probably was designed to be like a campus type of vehicle, right? Like in a university or an office park. not necessarily in the city.
That's exactly right. Or am I wrong? I mean, it was a low-speed vehicle, and you can only move up to 25 miles an hour. So we're thinking, you know, maybe large retirement communities or campuses.
Like a
shuttle that would just
you would get off and on. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And in that first phase, on that third generation of our driver, the goal was to actually build something that can take, you know, a fully autonomous trip. Right? And we actually did that in 2015. And, you know, we put a friend of our project, his name is Steve Mann, he happens to be blind. And in 2015, he took the first autonomous ride in Austin, Texas.
The first public person outside of Google.
That's right.
To take a ride. I remember this. This is a YouTube video of it. And it was in Austin. And that was kind of a big deal.
It was a huge moment when we were able to do this first ride in 2015. It was a big celebration after that.
Yeah, I can imagine. So at that point, you and your team had built this third generation version of the Waymo driver that could actually take a fully autonomous trip, which is a big deal. And you were essentially betting that this vehicle would keep passengers safe on real city streets, right? Like what went into the safety design?
That's right. That's right. It was also that early phase is what kind of forced us to start thinking about this very fundamental question. Like, of what does it mean for a self-driving, fully autonomous vehicle to be ready? Mm-hmm. Like, we set out on this path in 2013. Right? So, okay, you know, we're gonna need a car. It needs to have, you know, a bunch of safety systems. Does that exist? No. Okay, well, let's design one and work, you know, with partners to manufacture it. So we put a lot of thought and work into making it safe. It had like a foam, you know, front. It had a plexiglass window. The sensor pods, you know, were attached with magnets, so they, you know, could detach if something were to happen. The sensors at that time, you know, didn't have the level of reliability or capability that we would need, that we would trust, you know, to go to full autonomy. So we build, you know, that generation had our own LiDARs and, you know, a custom sensor suite. And then, of course, the software that we had to build, like that none of that existed.
So let's talk about the technology for a moment. Because you mentioned LiDAR and radar and some of these things, we know what they are. LiDAR, for example, uses basically light, lasers to measure distance. And you've got radar technology, cameras all over the car. Can you just kind of break down how they work? I mean, a lot of people who drive Teslas, for example, I have one. If you use the what Tesla calls full self-driving, which is not really full self-driving, but they rely primarily on cameras. They don't use LiDAR or radar technology. Tesla argues that is, the other ones are just redundancies that are unnecessary. Tell me how your technology works and why you think it's better.
Well, these sensors are, you know, they kind of have fundamentally different and complementary physical properties. Right. So cameras give you know, the high resolution and, you know, the richness of color.
How many cameras, by the way, on a Waymo vehicle now?
On the current generation, we have, I think, kind of all of them, including internal ones, we have 29 cameras.
29 cameras, okay. Yeah.
But they're passive sensors, right? You know, somebody else has to bring the light, whether it's your headlights or the sun. Radars and LiDARs, in contrast, are active sensors. So, you know, they blast, you know, their own energy out into the world, and then they, you know, get returns, and from that they can make sense of the environment. And they use, you know, different wavelengths. So they, like, can kind of punch through fog or rain much better than, you know, LiDAR or camera. Right? So you can, as a, you know, a human driver, I'm sure you can, you know, relate to how difficult it can be to drive at night, right? For example, at night, if you have, you know, somebody, you know, an oncoming car with their headlights on, you know, high beams, it kind of blinds you, right? It's very hard to see. Yep. It doesn't affect, you know, radar or LiDAR, or similarly, you know, driving in, you know, dense rain or fog. So this is why, you know, we think kind of using all of the sensors and, you know, fusing them in our, you know, AI and ML models, you know, so that you can kind of extract the best signal and see the world in the best possible way, gives us an advantage. And, you know, really, you can build, you know, a prototype, or you can, you know, build a driver assist system, you know, without needing all of that, you know, extra capability, extra redundancy. But if you really want to take the driver out and go for full autonomy, yeah, it gives you a boost.
All right. So just to clarify, like basically, you have the first successful ride with a third generation vehicle in 2015, and then in 2016, Waymo actually spins out of Google as an independent company, and then the next year, you become the first company to start like regularly operating these AVs in Chandler, Arizona. These are even more advanced than the previous version. What was the idea of like, hey, let's get these in really good shape, and then you know we'll turn them into like Ubers.
That's right. That's right. That you know, at that point we were pretty clear that was going to be our first deployment, our first product, and essentially that's what we launched in Chandler. You know, that's when we created the Waymo One product and the Waymo One application, and in 2018 in Chandler we started offering the service to external riders. And then in 2020 in Chandler, Arizona, we launched, the first fully autonomous ride-hailing service that was open to the public. Just anybody could just download the app and call a car. That was our fourth generation, Pacifica minivan. The empty car would go show up and take anywhere. So then we made this decision that it was not the best path forward to kind of incrementally grow and scale that system. We made the decision to make a hop to what we call the fifth generation of our driver. That's on the JLR I-Paces and Pacificas and a whole new...
This is the Jaguar.
That's right. And, we said, hey, let's take a big step. It's going to be a different car. It's going to be a new generation of hardware. It's going to be very different software with big bets on state-of-the-art AI. And, okay, let's go after the full complexity of the problem, including the full density of downtown Phoenix and downtown San Francisco. So that's what we were working on, in that time frame, to then on that new generation of the Waymo driver to launch the Waymo One service.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, how Waymo One works today and Dimitri's take on the future of autonomous vehicles. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Lab. Welcome back to How I Built This Lab. I'm Guy Raz. My guest is Dmitry Dolgov, the co-CEO of the autonomous vehicle company Waymo, which has started to roll out Waymo One, its autonomous ride-hailing service, in San Francisco. The city gave you permission to be a ride-hailing service for 24 hours a day, and I've used them probably a dozen times now. They're Jaguar SUVs, all electric. And they driving around the city, and you just order it like an Uber. You just go out and you go on your app, and it comes, and then you unlock the door with your phone, and you get in, and you hit start, and it goes. And I can't even tell you how many times the first question I get from people is, "Aren't you scared? Aren't you terrified when you get in one of these things?" And so I have my answer. So what's your answer when people say that to you? Like, this just seems terrifying for a machine to drive you around a city. Like, it seems so scary. Like, it could, it could just go haywire and drive off a bridge or something. What do you say to people when they ask you that?
Well, I at this point, I think I'm much more anxious about human drivers than I am about the Waymo driver. So I have, full confidence. But of course, I've been in those cars, many, many times, hundreds, thousands of times over the years. But what we see with other people, like, it's very natural to have that anxiety. It's a very different, very new system and new product. But what we very consistently see, and I guess I would love to hear if that matches your experience, but once people get in the car, after a couple of minutes, they get very comfortable. And they go back to doing whatever they want to be doing, like back on their phone and check. Yeah, exactly.
I know. I took my son in it, and drove across San Francisco, and within like 30 seconds or 45 seconds, the first time ever he's in there, he's like back looking at his phone, and it's true. It's you get in it and then it goes, and it's really cool. You're looking out and looking at the steering wheel turn for the first 45 seconds, and then you're done. And then you're just like going back to what you were doing, answering emails or whatever. But it is amazing that it, you know, how sort of bizarrely ordinary it feels after a couple of seconds.
Yeah, but that's great.
Yeah.
Right. I mean that's incredibly exciting, and I think, you know, some people kind of draw this parallel that, you know, kind of your brain switches to passenger mode.
Yeah.
And yeah, you do get all of these benefits of, you know, privacy, whether you want to have a conversation with somebody in the car that you are in the car with, or you want to make a, you know, phone call. And I mean, yeah, that's exactly, you know, why we're so excited about this product.
All right. So Dimitri, in general, right, I'm optimistic when it comes to technology, but I have to also admit that healthy skepticism is important, right? I mean, we've been promised technologies that are going to make our lives better and change the world, only to be, sorely disappointed by them. I think it's really amazing what's happening with autonomous vehicles. But I guess I wonder, you know, do you understand some of the cause for concern or some of the skepticism around it?
Yes, I think it's very natural. That is very new technology. It's, you know, very different. So I think if you look back in history, it's very common that when a new thing comes around, there is skepticism.
Yep.
There are lots of questions. There is, you know, excitement, but there's also, you know, a lot of sensitivity.
But I wonder, I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, you know, don't worry, this is going to be okay. But how can you guarantee or convince people that the technology couldn't be misused, couldn't be, you know, manipulated in a way that endangers human life?
Well, I guess, you know, I would start with the status quo, right? We are not okay, right? If you look at just how many lives are lost to the transportation system that we have today. I'm sure you've, you've heard these numbers before, but, you know, well known that in the U.S. alone, more than 40,000 people die every year. I just need to take a step back. It's kind of insane.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine, you know, if we were to invent cars today or transportation system, like no way we would allow this. Right. And I think over time, we just kind of slowly boiled ourselves, society, to, you know, accept that. Right. And I think as a first order impact of this technology, you know, we can do better. We can do much better. And we are, you know, we're seeing that today. We have driven, you know, north of 5 million fully autonomous miles today.
Yeah.
And we've shared some data from, you know, the safety impact that our cars have. And I think at this point, we have a fairly robust body of evidence that shows that, you know, our cars actually have very clear safety benefits where they operate.
How do we think about, and there's no easy answer right now because it's all both an ethical and a legal question, but how do we think about liability, right? I mean, if, let's say, I own a car that is fully autonomous with Waymo's technology, let's say in 10 years from now, and I'm in the back and I'm just doing my work, or I'm asleep, you know, which I'd rather be doing. I just go to sleep and let it drive me from San Francisco to LA, which would be great, but it gets in an accident, a fluke accident. Maybe another car hits it or something. How do we account for liability? I mean, who's responsible? Is the owner of the car? Is Waymo's technology? Like, how is that going to work?
For the actions of, you know, the Waymo driver,
yeah,
the responsibility, you know, lies, you know, with Waymo. If it was, you know, the fault of, you know, another actor, another driver, then you kind of follow the established, you know, processes that are, you know, well understood and well studied by, you know, for example, insurance companies. That's, you know, they have, you know, decades of experience of kind of evaluating exactly that,
right,
you know, that question. And this is where, I think, that study that Swiss Re has done was very encouraging, that when they looked at, you know, almost 4 million miles of, you know, our fully autonomous operation, they found that massive reduction in, you know, 100% reduction in the, you know, bodily injury claims and, you know, 4x reduction in property damage, right? So that then you can apply, like you can marry the two, and you're starting to see the benefits.
So if Waymo is, I mean, basically, if in a future scenario, somebody's in a Waymo car and the Waymo vehicle crashes and there's some kind of fluke and Waymo is responsible. I mean, you guys have to accept that liability, but I guess in order to get to that position, you have to be rock solid confident that that will never happen.
Well, that's what we spend, that's one of the hardest questions that we spend, you know, more than a decade working on. We've developed a very robust, multifaceted readiness and safety framework, and actually that's something we shared publicly. And you know, it's that what we see in all of those methodologies as we improve and validate our system, that at the end of the day is what gives us confidence in the performance of the system.
How many cars do you have on the streets of San Francisco now?
We have a fleet in San Francisco of about 250 vehicles. You know, they're not all out at the same time, but it gives you an approximate order of magnitude.
And Phoenix?
About the same. I want to say about a couple hundred cars as well.
So here's a question. I mean, is the part of the business model right now for Waymo to become like a ride-hailing service? Like, you know, I'm sure, I know you've got a partnership that you announced with Uber, but I mean, is the idea that, you know, in 10 years' time, this is going to be the primary, your primary business or a part of what you do? Give me a sense is Waymo going to be a ride-hailing service or is it going to be a technology company that licenses its technology to both ride-hailing services and automobile manufacturers and others?
Well, we think of ourselves as, you know, building a generalizable Waymo driver. And the business model is to deploy it in different product lines, different commercial applications. There's three main ones. Ride-hailing, that's what we call Waymo One.
Yep.
And then there's, you know, trucking and deliveries, moving goods. And then the third one is personally owned vehicles. So that's the long-term vision. Like, we want, you know, the driver, there's trillions of miles being, you know, traveled. I think there's almost 3 trillion in the US alone, you know, much more in the across the world. So we want to have, you know, a positive impact on, you know, some meaningful fraction of all of those miles. So, you know, the first business and the first product is Waymo One and, you know, ride hailing. But we're exploring, you know, different, you know, other different partnerships. Like you just mentioned that the Uber partnership that we just launched, I think, where it is.
And that partnership, by the way, is what is that going to look like? It's going to be the Uber app will also hail Waymo cars?
That's right. That's right. You can use the Uber app and get a fully autonomous vehicle.
This is not a money-making operation for Waymo right now. I mean, the ride-hailing service is still in its infancy, but you know, there's been billions of dollars invested into Waymo, and I have to imagine ride-hailing is not where you're going to make your money. It's going to be from selling this technology. So, tell me, just from the business perspective, when do you see a path to profitability?
Well, you know, challenge a little bit that, you know, ride hailing is a massive opportunity.
Yeah.
It is, yeah, you know, a very big market today, but, you know, it's growing. There's expectations that it's going to be significantly bigger by, you know, the end of the decade. But if you, on top of that, if you factor in, the benefits and the, you know, positive economics that fully autonomous vehicles can bring to the table, there's potential for that to, you know, expand quite a bit. So, you know, we were very, you know, laser focused on that as our primary business line. You know, beyond that, you know, we want to pursue trucking and deliveries and then eventually personally owned vehicles. But ride hailing, I would not dismiss that at all.
So probably unrealistic to say that within 10 years, ordinary people could buy a fully autonomous vehicle for themselves, but probably not unrealistic to say that in 10 years from now, in most major urban centers in the U.S., there will be autonomous taxis available for anybody to use.
I definitely agree with the latter, and I would not dismiss the former. 10 years is a, you know, reasonably long time, and, you know, things can happen nonlinearly.
So, final question for you. So, I mean, if the future is autonomous, and I think it is, I really do. I'm convinced. I think anybody who uses one of these taxis will see it. It's so clear. At least to me, you know, you go in it and it's a clean car. It's a very good driver. It's a defensive driver, but it's also not overly defensive. So it's not timid. It's like a very good, you know, taxi driver. better. So that, I think, is the future. So, Dimitri, I know that, you know, there are plenty of people who love driving, right, who love the experience of controlling their car. And those people will continue to want to have that ability, and they will. But in your view, are we looking at a future where most people are going to be driven by their cars?
In the long-term future, I think, yes. I think that that's where, you know, we're heading. Maybe, you know, taking your car in the future to a racetrack and driving it manually, that's going to be the kind of the novel and an exciting thing, rather than the mundane kind of boring task of driving, commuting. And if you imagine a future where, you know, a large fraction of your cars on the road are, you know, fully autonomous or at least smart enough, then you can start doing things where you're optimizing, you know, more globally. Like they can coordinate, you know, their speed. You can, you know, connect them to smarter infrastructure and actually overall increase the throughput of your roads and could, you know, kind of increase the throughput of your transportation system. And, you know, farther out in the future, if you look there today, personally owned vehicles are can sit around for 90% of their, you know, the lifetime, right? You know, you take them, you know, home or work, and then you park it, and then, you know, 9 out of 10 hours is just sitting there. So if that changes, right, if you no longer have to have your, you know, car just sitting there for you, it just opens up, there's a lot more space that can be, you know, used in cities for other more interesting things.
Dimitri, thank you so much.
That was a pleasure. Thank you, Guy.
That's Dimitri Dolgov, co-CEO of Waymo. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Please make sure to click the follow button on your podcast app so you never miss a new episode of the show. And as always, it's free. This episode was produced by Carrie Thompson with editing by John Isabella and research help from Chris Messini. Our music was composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Our audio engineer was Neil Rausch. Our production team at How I Built This includes Alex Chung, Carla Estevez, Casey Herman, Chris Messini, Elaine Coates, JC Howard, Malia Agudelo, Neva Grant, Sam Paulson, and Catherine Seifer. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This Lab. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.